have 2 p.m. Here in New York City. Good afternoon. My name is Michael Spooner. I'm a managing partner at We Family Offices in New York City and a founder and board member of the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard. On behalf of the Institute, thank you all for joining the call today. The Institute is pleased to host today's call, the kickoff to several planned events we call Fiduciary September. Fiduciary September, founded in 2012, is one of the core programs of the Institute, which exists to promote the vital importance of the fiduciary standard in investment and financial advice. In particular, the Institute is focused directly on investor and advisor education and awareness about the standard and why it matters. Our hope is that all of you will not only find today's update on regulatory reform informative and useful, but that you will also help raise awareness among investors about these critical issues in your ensuing coverage and articles. For more information on additional Fiduciary September events, please visit the Institute's website at www.thefiduciaryinstitute.org. Upcoming highlights include a live podcast discussion with Vanguard founder Jack Bogle on September 9th at 11 a.m. and the Frankel Fiduciary Prize Symposium on September 19th at Columbia University Law School, which will honor former CFTC Chair Gary Gensler and feature, among other speakers, former SEC Chair Arthur Levitt. This afternoon, we're pleased to have Tara Siegel-Bernard, a respected journalist at the New York Times, moderating our panel discussion. Tara will begin by introducing each of the panelists to whom we are enormously grateful for their time and participation. Tara?
Hi, everyone. Welcome. I figure we'll just jump right in. As most of you probably know, not all financial professionals are legally required to act in their consumers' or customers' best interests. Brokers are not always required to put their customers' interests ahead of their own, a legal standard known as fiduciary duty. Today's panel, all top experts in their fields, are going to discuss what would seem to be a basic protection, but it's proven to be rather controversial. 4 years ago, Dodd-Frank gave the SEC the authority to write rules that would require brokers to act as fiduciaries, but those efforts appear to have stalled. The Department of Labor, which oversees retirement plans, meanwhile, is working on its own set of standards, which would require more financial professionals to act as fiduciaries when dealing with their retirement accounts. After proposing a new rule 4 years ago and then rescinding the rule, they are scheduled to repropose one by early next year. So where does all this stand now and what's ahead? That's what our five panelists are going to discuss today, help bring us up to speed. Before I introduce the panelists, I just wanted to lay a few quick ground rules. After each of our speakers make their own remarks, we're going to have time for questions. But until we get to that point, if you can press your mute button if you haven't already, since this is a live line and we all could hear one another, that would be super. And if you have a question that comes up during the course of one of the speakers' remarks, please email them to me as soon as possible, and then I could kind of organize them and we can go through them once the Q&A opens up. My email address is my first name, Tara, T as in Tom, A-R-A at nytimes.com. And just state your name and affiliation in your email. And then with that, let's introduce the speakers. First, we'll hear from Barbara Roper, Director of Investor Protection at the Consumer Federation. Next up will be David Certner, Legislative Counsel and Legislative Policy Director for Government Affairs at AARP. Dennis Kelleher, President and Chief Executive of Better Markets, a nonpartisan consumer watchdog group, and who before that held several senior staff positions in the U.S. Senate. Next is Cheryl Garrett, founder of the Garrett Planning Network, a network of fee-only financial advisors across the country. And finally, we're going to hear from Mary Malguar, founder of The Family Firm, a fee-only financial advisory firm and former president of NAPFA, the National Association of Financial Planners. So let's get started with you, Barbara. It's been four years since Dodd-Frank and the SEC was given, which gave the SEC the authority to right rules that would require brokers to act in their customers' best interest. But they aren't actually required to do anything or write the rule. So can you start by laying the groundwork for us? You know, do you think the SEC will actually move forward at all? And what are the biggest obstacles? Or is it simply that the majority of commissioners at the SEC simply believe a universal fiduciary standard is not necessary?
Thanks, Tara, and thanks to all of you who've joined the call today. I think in order to answer this latter part of that question, what are the obstacles, what are the prospects for reform, it helps to take one step back and just quickly on this issue of SEC fiduciary duty, talk first about what exactly the problem is that we're trying to solve. Then I'll talk about where we stand in terms of the SEC's efforts to solve it, and finally explain what some of the reasons are that something that should be so simple has proven to be so difficult. So first question, what exactly is the problem we're trying to solve here? Stated in its starkest terms, the problem is that investors who are in the market for investment advice are being actively deceived, and SEC regulatory policy permits that deception. So that's a provocative statement. What do I mean by that? You know, brokers and investment advisors both call themselves advisors. They both offer services such as retirement planning and investment planning that are or should be advisory in nature. And they both market themselves to the public as if personalized investment advice is the primary service they provide to clients. And as a result, they are indistinguishable to the investing public. But brokers aren't, in fact, advisors, at least not legally. They are salespeople. The standard that governs their so-called advice, the suitability standard, is a sales standard that allows them to make recommendations that put their own financial interests ahead of those of their clients. And pervasive incentives in the broker-dealer compensation system encourage them to do just that. That is not what people expect and have every right to expect when they consult a financial advisor. So the problem is not simply that brokers and investment advisors offer the same services to clients under different standards, though that is on its face hard to justify. And it certainly isn't that investors are confused, though they unquestionably are. The problem is that a fiduciary duty, an obligation to act in the best interest of the customer, is in and of itself what distinguishes advice from a sales pitch. By allowing brokers to offer, quote unquote, advice without requiring them to act in their customers' best interest, the SEC is permitting them to deceive investors about the nature of the services they are offering. And just to be clear, this is not a problem that is created by the statute that governs broker-dealers and investment advisors. It is a problem that has been created by the SEC's misguided interpretation of those statutes over several decades. Before Dodd-Frank was ever enacted, the SEC had all the authority it needed under the Investment Advisors Act to say that brokers who want to act as advisors and market themselves as advisors would be regulated accordingly. Had the SEC done that in the late 1980s and early 90s, we would arguably not be having this discussion today. So where does the SEC stand on fixing this problem that it created? SEC Chair, as you probably know, Mary Jo White has said publicly that she's asked the staff to prepare a list of alternatives for addressing the issue and that she expects the commission to decide this year on whether to move forward with rulemaking. And I've spoken to her personally, and when we've spoken, Chair White gives every impression that this is also a personal priority for her. Both Commissioner Aguilar and Commissioner Stein have expressed their support for a strong, uniform fiduciary standard for personalized investment advice, and the SEC's Investor Advisory Committee, of which I'm a member, has adopted a strong set of recommendations calling for rulemaking. At the same time, however, the two Republican commissioners have made it clear in their public statements that they question the need for rulemaking. While in one sense that division within the commission makes the chair's job more challenging, in another sense it could be viewed as liberating. If the position of the Republic commissioners is and remains, in essence, just say no, then the chair can and should view herself as freed from having to negotiate to win their support by watering down the standards. She'd have to have the courage to take a 3-2 vote in support of a fiduciary standard, but she showed just last week with a 3-2 vote in support of strengthening credit rating agency rules that she is willing to do that when necessary. And while we'd certainly prefer to see this issue, you know, we don't believe this is inherently should be a partisan issue, we do also believe that it's important enough that a 3-2 vote would be justified if that's what it takes to move forward with rulemaking. So why the opposition? Why is this so difficult? You know, if you ask the average person on the street whether financial professionals who offer the same services should be subject to the same regulatory standards, their answer is obvious. Of course they should. And if you ask them whether their advisor should have to act in their best interest, the answer is the same. So why has it proven so difficult to adopt a regulatory policy that matches the reasonable expectations of the investing public? What are the obstacles? The problem, to be frank, starts with the SEC staff itself. For whatever reason, there seems to be a reluctance within the staff, and particularly within the Division of Trading and Markets, to acknowledge any problem with a regulatory policy that has allowed brokers to remake themselves as advisors while still regulating them as salespeople. You know, I've been meeting with the SEC staff on this issue for years, decades. And at some point in those meetings, someone from the SEC staff inevitably asks, well, you know, is the fiduciary duty really a higher standard than suitability? Or they make the point that brokers are subject to more rigorous regulatory oversight, as if that was relevant to the standard that should apply when brokers provide advisory services. So ironically, the main broker-dealer trade association, SIFMA, appears to have a more evolved position on fiduciary duty than do some of the very SEC staffers we rely on to craft those rules. And that, presumably, is how you end up with a document like the request for information that the SEC put out on this issue last year that managed to define fiduciary duty without ever once mentioning the best interest obligation that should be its central component. To overcome that obstacle, the SEC will need to be willing to put oversight of this rulemaking process in the hands of individuals within the agency who support the project and who are committed to adopting a rule that does not water down the existing fiduciary standard for personalized investment advice. Another obstacle to rulemaking is that the problem that rulemaking is designed to solve often gets mischaracterized. In particular, people, including people of good intent, focus on investor confusion as if that was the problem in need of a solution. And those who resist regulation inevitably then respond that if investor confusion is the problem, then the solution is simply to adopt better disclosures and to educate investors. But this completely misses the point of why investor confusion is important. Investor confusion is relevant here precisely because it limits the available regulatory solutions. If investors can't distinguish brokers from advisors, and they can't even after the differences are explained to them, then disclosure will never be adequate to solve the problem associated with inconsistent regulatory standards. And the notion of informed investor choice between two equally valid business models is an illusion. Perhaps the most significant obstacle we face, however, is that we operate in an era where economic analysis has become a tool not to promote good, thoughtful regulation, but simply to gum up the regulatory process. And that has certainly been a problem here, where even today, the question continues to be asked, where is the evidence of harm that justifies rulemaking? And it doesn't matter how much evidence one submits, the question is repeated as if nothing has changed. That's one of the reasons that I stated the problem so starkly at the outset of my remarks, because when you conduct economic analysis, you have to start with the right question if you want to arrive at a logical regulatory solution. So to the question, where's the harm? The first answer is that investors who go out into the market seeking advice, which, again, by definition means recommendations designed to promote their best interests, are being deceived into purchasing services that do not meet those reasonable expectations. It shouldn't take a genius to understand that SEC policy should not promote deception or misrepresentation, and that action is needed to correct that problem. This is particularly true when the evidence also overwhelmingly suggests that its investors suffer real financial harm, albeit unquantifiable harm, as a result of biased advice to invest in products that have unnecessarily high costs, that expose them to excessive risks, or that simply offer mediocre performance relative to other options available in the market. In short, if the SEC frames the issue correctly, then rulemaking becomes easy to justify on economic grounds. And the question then is not, or should not be, where's the economic data to support regulation? The question is, or should be, where is the data that justifies maintaining the status quo? So I'd like to make one quick final point about obstacles to progress, and that is the language of the Dodd-Frank Act itself. The legislation is obviously well-intended, and we greatly appreciate the Herculean efforts that were made to win its inclusion in the final bill. But the reality is that some of the concessions that were made in the process make it difficult but not impossible, to draft a good rule based on that language. For the SEC to develop a strong pro-investor fiduciary standard based on that Dodd-Frank authorization, it will need to interpret key provisions, in particular provisions on non-going duty of care and limited menu of products, very carefully, to ensure that they do not create loopholes that render the effort meaningless. In closing, I'd just like to repeat, this should not be a partisan issue. Rooting out misrepresentations, promoting fair competition, harnessing market forces to benefit rather than harm investors is a policy that should be able to win bipartisan support. But if Chair White must take a 3-2 vote to bring it about, so be it. This is an issue of sufficient importance to the basic financial well-being of millions of investors that the chair must be willing to take that vote. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Barb. Next, we're going to hear from David Sertner of AARP. So, David, there's been a lot of talk about how a fiduciary standard would result in fewer people, particularly lower and middle-income people, having access to advice. Can you walk us through that argument and give us your thoughts?
Sure. Thanks, Tara. And I think that's simply a red herring. The issue here is really getting people good advice, not advice that's subject to conflicts. And the fiduciary standard already exists in the marketplace. And the value of having updated regulations is to move the market in the direction of providing quality, non-conflicted advice to all investors. I mean, some people have actually gone so far as to say that bad advice is better than no advice. And that's a false choice, and not one that we would really stand for in other circumstances. I mean, would we say that, you know, bad medical practice is better than no medical practice at all, or bad legal advice is better than no legal advice at all? That's not the choice here. What we should be doing is ensuring that all investors receive the advice that's in their best interest. And that leads us right into the importance of the fiduciary standard in protecting American workers and other investors who are trying to plan for secure retirement. Over the past 30 years, there's been this dramatic shift into individual account type plans. So the decline in traditional defined benefit plans in this country has given way to the rise of 401k plans. And not only that, but there is now more money in individual retirement accounts, primarily through a lot of rollover money from these plans, than there actually is in 401k plans. So what we have with this ongoing shift in individual account plans is an increase in the number of Americans who need retirement advice. And the effort by the SEC and the Department of Labor to update these rules to ensure that the fiduciary duty of care covers all financial professionals who offer advice is really one of the most important steps that we can take now to promote retirement security for the average investor. This issue is of such high importance to AARP for the simple fact that individuals today shoulder the bulk of the risk and the responsibility for investing for retirement. Individuals bear the ultimate risk of getting it right or suffering real consequences for their income security during their retirement years. And more than ever before, as I've laid out, it's the individual who has to make the complicated decisions about how much money to save and what to invest in and how to adjust investments as you approach retirement and what steps to take to make investments last throughout their retirement. And the reality is that most people lack the skills, the time, the information to make these decisions. And so they are understandably more and more turning to investment professionals for help. And we have to begin with the basic fact that most Americans who turn to financial professionals for help assume that the advice they're getting, including any advice they're getting in their retirement accounts, is based on their best interests. And unfortunately, too often that's not the case. And as Barb laid out, unless a professional operates under fiduciary duty, the advisor could be providing advice tainted by their own interests. And again, these services that are provided are usually indistinguishable investor. But as Barb noted, investment advisors and broker-dealers are regulated under different frameworks. Investment advisors are subject to the fiduciary duty, and they have an affirmative duty to act in the best interest of the clients and to make full and fair disclosure to their clients regarding any conflicts. And brokers do not. Brokers are simply required to make recommendations that are generally, quote-unquote, suitable for the investor. And as a result, brokers are free to receive higher compensation, for example, for recommending a particular product, even if another product would be better, without having to disclose this to the consumer. And meanwhile, even though brokers are regulated and conduct themselves as salespeople, they've encouraged investors to rely on them as advisors, often marketing their services as financial advisors, and in fact taking advantage of this consumer confusion. And again, consumers don't distinguish between these various types of financial professionals. They don't know about the regulatory differences, and they simply expect advice from either to be in their best interest. And we've done surveys on this of both employers and plan participants, and both, by overwhelming numbers, said that they want the fiduciary rule to apply. And that's why this is so important. All too often, retirement savers will see the value of their savings eroded either by fees and costs that are higher than necessary or returns that are lower than they could be. And under the worst circumstances, investors are not just getting bad advice and costly advice, but actually predatory advice. And over time, these costs can be great. And I think it's one way to look at it is this. When the stock market dropped 25%, as it did in the economic crisis, the whole nation and millions of individuals were thrown into economic turmoil. But when you have a single percentage point in additional fees or lower returns annually over a lifetime, it produces essentially the same type of loss for the investor. And while the nation reacts very strongly to the earthquake of a sudden loss, we need to react similarly to losses that add up over time. And while conflict is more of a termite effect as opposed to an earthquake effect, the losses can be just as dramatic and significant. And so with the SEC and the DOL both in the process of deciding whether to close regulatory loopholes, the goals of their complementary efforts should really be quite simple, that all those who provide individualized financial advice about investments and retirement accounts are held to a fiduciary standard. In other words, managing conflicts of interest and acting in the best interests of the investors they are serving. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Now we're going to move on to Dennis Kelleher. Dennis, the Labor Department is trying to update a 1975 rule which outlines when investment advisors must become fiduciaries when dealing with their retirement accounts like IRAs and 401ks. So first, can you explain how the fiduciary rule that applies to retirement accounts is stricter than the fiduciary rule that applies to registered investment advisors? And why it needs to be updated. And then finally, you know, why is the financial services industry so against it, especially considering they seem to be somewhat on board for a fiduciary rule for brokers from the SEC?
Well, taking the second one first, Barbara and others can chime in on this, but I wouldn't say that the industry is against this rule when they are in favor of a rule in the SEC space. In fact, I think as David just suggested, the industry is against the rule in both spaces. There are times when the different parts of the industry make sounds suggesting that they are in favor of a uniform rule in the SEC going first. But it, when you get below kind of the headline, what they really want is a lower standard of suitability, not a fiduciary duty standard where they're required to act in the best interest of their clients, applicable in the SEC area as well as in the DOL ERISA area. I think that one of the things going on now is a lot of the attention of the opposition is focused on the Department of Labor, because the Department of Labor appears to be moving in the near term on a proposing a fiduciary duty rule, where the SEC, as Barbara eloquently pointed out, the word movement, SEC, and fiduciary duty are not in the same sentence. They're not even in kind of the same book. They're moving so slow. So that's as to the second one. As to the first one, let me just take a step back, because I think, Terry, you mentioned a very important point, which is that the rule that right now that governs the DOL rule that governs ERISA plans was passed in 1975. So let's just call that 40 years ago. And it's really quite remarkable that anyone would tolerate a 40-year-old rule, a rule that has not been changed in 40 years, governing how people, the duty under which people obtain investment advice. If you think about it, the retirement circumstances facing American workers and families today in 2014 are so dramatically different than they were 40 years ago, it's almost impossible to describe. 1975 was an entirely different world than that facing American savings for retirement today. So, for example, gone are the days when many workers could count on an employer-based, professionally managed defined benefit plan. They now find themselves in a you're-on-your-own world of defined contribution plans with a dizzying array of products, services, and advice. And most people find themselves just woefully inadequate to navigate these complex choices and turn to advisors they trust and believe already act in their best interest. And just one data point to highlight the difference between 1975 and now. In 1975, when the rule was passed that's applicable today, IRAs had just been created, and 401ks did not even exist in 1975. Today, there are $6.5 trillion in IRAs, and there are $5.9 trillion in assets in 401ks. So the rules governing those $5.9 trillion in assets in 401ks, the rules were created at a time before 401ks were created. So it's absolutely astonishing. It's as if you pick anything that existed in 1975. It's as if Gerald Ford was still president, for example. We didn't change presidents. The Sony introduced the Betamax video cassette recorder in 1975. If nothing else changed in music since 1975, we'd still have the Betamax. But that, of course, is illogical and nonsensical. Similarly, the rules that governed music in 1975 and virtually everything else have changed. The one rule that has not changed, I shouldn't say the one rule, there's probably others, but the one rule that is really dramatically important, impacts tens of millions of Americans, that hasn't changed for 40 years, is the rule governing the duty of those giving advice in connection with ERISA plans like 401ks and IRAs, which now have about $12 trillion. And the other thing that's a little bit amazing is that the rule adopted in 1975 actually allows there to be undisclosed conflicts of interest and hidden fees. And no one, or I should say who, in their right mind would give their hard-earned money to somebody to invest for their retirement to a person who didn't have to act in their best interest. Or, put it differently, who would give their hard-earned money to somebody who actually was knowingly allowed to have undisclosed conflicts of interest and permitted that person to put their own economic interest above the interest of the person entrusting them to give them advice about their retirement savings? The simple answer to both questions is no one would. And yet that is what is happening today to tens of millions of Americans, because that's what the Department of Labor's outdated 40-year-old rule allows. So what you have, as David and Barbara so well stated, is a circumstance where the rules allow people giving substantively the exact same sales pitch slash investment advice to be governed by a much lower standard than a client's best interest standard. And the solution, of course, is to pass a rule requiring those giving such advice to act in the best interest of the people who are seeking advice about their retirement savings. And keep in mind, every day in this country, 10,000 Americans reach the age of 65. 10,000 Americans, and that every day, that's expected to continue for almost 20 more years. So we have about 70 million Americans over the next decade plus who are going to be retiring and therefore going to need as much money as they can save for retirement to have a secure retirement and have a decent standard of living in retirement, which is why it is so incredibly important to make sure that any funds that they are saving and investing for retirement go to their retirement and not siphoned off by undisclosed conflicts of interest and or hidden fees, which would not be permitted under a best interest standard. Now, the Department of Labor is on the precipice of proposing a rule to require a best interest fiduciary duty standard for those offering advice in connection with or related to ERISA plans. And it was, as you said earlier, Tara, they proposed one several years ago that was withdrawn after there was a variety of criticisms, much of which were unfair and misleading, some of which had merit to them. The Department of Labor then considered criticism and are proposing a new rule, hopefully soon, that addresses the meritorious complaints and observations and input and comes out with a rule that actually requires people to act in the best interest of those savings for retirement in connection with ERISA plans.
Great.
And that's where that is.
Thanks so much, Dennis. Next up is Cheryl Garrett. Cheryl, it seems that a big fear of some brokers is that they're not going to be able to operate within their current business model if they're also required to act as fiduciaries. But you had also mentioned that, you know, some of these folks don't really know what fiduciary duty entails. So in practice, how should all of this shake out? And, you know, are these brokers going to be willing to disclose all the kind of nitty-gritty details that fiduciaries are required to today?
That's a great question. I have my opinions on many parts of this, so I'm going to take the first point about the big fear. And I think actually there's more fear from a few of the more limited scope or limited menu of products type of companies. I don't want to name any specific names of financial services companies, but those how to talk without naming names. There are a handful of companies remaining, and there are fewer now than there used to be just 5 or 10, 15 years ago. And what we're seeing is a transition toward independent companies, independent broker-dealers, self-employed financial advisors. And the reason for this shift toward independence has been that the individual advisor is wanting to have the freedom to uphold their belief in doing what's best for their client and live by the fiduciary standard. Nearly every financial advisor or financial planner that I've spoken with or come in contact with believe that they put their client's best interest first, and they're willing to embrace this requirement, even if they don't officially have that requirement now. They aren't afraid of the burden of regulation, although their employer or their company may be. if they have to make a major shift. And we may very likely see some companies go out of business and many companies need to evolve. However, that is not going to be the majority. I think we've already seen a major evolution with the majority of financial services companies to provide a lot more freedom and flexibility with their advisors that are working through them.
Learned a lot. It was a great experience.
Getting a lot of background noise.
We need to learn about the whole debate regarding paying college taxes.
I mean, I think that
maybe it's the hold button on someone's phone.
I mean, you understand business. And
someone's got ESPN.
I'm going to talk through it if you don't mind, Tara.
Okay, go ahead.
It'll be a scrambled message, but hopefully it'll come through. So, you know, there is a fear, definitely, we're hearing that from the lobbyists that are arguing that a fiduciary duty imposed on all advisors will take away jobs. It will take away choices individual consumers of advice. But actually, what I see it as is we are seeing this evolution. It's been going on for a number of years where the companies that were employing financial advisors have to start providing more flexibility so that the advisors can do what they inherently want to do, and that is to act in the client's best interest.
For these folks who might not be able to do this.
Financial advisor and financial planner community can and will adapt if they need to and if they want to. But I'm hearing that they absolutely want to. A few major companies with captive agents or reps and limited product selection will either evolve or they'll go out of business. You know, that's the nature of capitalism. And you know, we are seeing upstarts, we are seeing transitions, we are seeing major companies completely evolve and becoming much more independent and allowing different representatives and advisors within their framework or their network to be able to provide the kind of advice that would meet the fiduciary standard. And it's been evolving very rapidly over the last 5 to 10 years. So this is just a natural evolution. It's not something that we have to protect, as we've heard on the Hill. And you know, if we don't kill this idea of, you know, having individual clients or consumers of financial advice have their expectations met that, you know, if I hire somebody to give me advice about something, I ought to be able to anticipate that they're going to
have it in the USA Today and other publications about it. So I support it as best way I can, but I don't think that they need to.
Hi, I just want to remind everybody to please put your phones on mute.
Okay, active player. There are a lot of former players who
somebody walked away from their desk.
Somebody probably has the call on hold.
More yeah. Academic opportunity in order to focus on sports. They have nothing to show for it, but
okay, well, thank you, Cheryl.
That's a big issue, though, overall, whether it's healthcare issues or what do you do after life, after
less
whatever.
Less than ideal.
So many stories about professional athletes.
I'm also just want to remind everybody to send me a question, send me your questions if you have them.
Absolutely, and I think
Tara@nytimes.com.
This is also a problem. I think in
hi, Tara. This is Cheryl. I fell off the line.
Okay. I thought.
Clear. The athletes are also.
Continue.
But sorry. With all the background noise, you hardly noticed, huh? So I absolutely think that we're going to see a transition and we've got an evolving, growing industry, and it's a good thing that it's evolving. It's evolving in the right direction. It's natural that we're meeting or wanting to meet the needs of the client in their best interest. So individual advisors, for the overwhelming majority of individual advisors, want to be held to a fiduciary standard.
And you're out and you have
the 40 Act fiduciary standard. You might not necessarily know all that implies, but best interest, you know, that is an absolute, avoiding conflicts of interest, managing them appropriately, and so forth. But when it comes down to disclosing everything, I mean, other people have talked about disclosures and the challenges there. And one of your questions, Tara, was, you know, do I think most brokers are going to be willing to disclose all of the details of how they are paid? Technically, how they are paid is required now, such as I'm paid commissions or I'm paid fees and commissions or something along those lines. The key is really, to me, is how much they are paid for what services are going to be rendered. Because if one is trying to evaluate, am I getting what I need for a price that I'm willing to pay, and you're looking around to do some comparison shopping or being able to evaluate the choices of service providers without knowing how much one is going to be paid or how much you as the consumer are going to have to pay, you can't make an evaluation. And that's currently how the rules are for every non-fiduciary. There's no disclosure regarding how much they're paid. Now, here's the rub. Because a good majority, or close to all, if not all, of non-fiduciaries, in other words, brokers, they don't have to disclose how much they're paid. But if they were working under a fiduciary standard, as financial advisors, investment advisors, they would have to disclose every material fact. And I think compensation is pretty material, how much somebody's going to pay for services. So how much you're paid would have to be determined. But because of the way the services are currently rendered, oftentimes a broker might make a proposal to a client or prospective client, and the client says, well, I may or may not want that, or they do a financial plan for them, and there may not be a cost for that financial plan initially, or maybe there's a fee involved. And then upon implementation of the financial plan, that's when the real compensation gets kicked in, and that makes all the difference in the world. But until you know what somebody is going to implement or follow, which recommendations they're going to follow, you don't know the absolute cost involved. But that doesn't have to stay that way. We need clarity, because without clarity, people can't make good decisions. We would ask those kind of details in buying a car or buying a house. We would expect that at least when we're buying financial services.
Great. We are getting several questions in, so I want to leave enough time for those who are 15 minutes away. Thank you so much, Cheryl. And I just want to repeat, I guess the person who has us on hold is not going to hear this message. but just as a reminder, if you have to put us on hold, maybe you can somehow arrange to do that on mute instead. Moving along to Mary Malguar, you had mentioned that most investors don't really know the difference between salespeople and advice givers, and they expect they can trust both. So even beyond a fiduciary standard, what sort of practical guidelines should all professionals selling products or providing advice adhere to? The Institute, I believe, recently released some guidelines. Can you talk a bit about those, too, briefly? Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to make my comments very short so that we can leave enough time to answer questions and respond to the people online. First of all, I agree with
conference muted.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
What happened?
I lost everyone.
Yeah, this is Tara. I'm here too, but I see. Everybody here?
David's
Mark or Chef.
Cheryl's here.
Okay.
Maybe we lost Mary?
I think Mary fell off.
Okay. Well, maybe let's just launch right into questions, and then she could wrap up later. So Melanie Waddell of Think Advisor and Investment Advisor magazine had a really interesting question. What are the worst uniform fiduciary scenarios that could come out of a rule? As White said, there are various ways to create a uniform fiduciary rulemaking. That's for anyone on the panel.
So this is Barb. I'll jump in. So the worst The worst outcome is that the SEC adopts a rule that pretends to be a fiduciary standard that's really just suitability with a few added disclosures. And that was what the request for information looked like when they did their request for data in support of rulemaking, and they walked through what, you know, the questions that they asked. They never included a best interest obligation as part of their definition of fiduciary. So that's the worst outcome. And the reason that's bad is because the way this is likely to be adopted is that there will be side-by-side rulemaking under the Advisors Act and the Broker-Dealer Act. And so you could actually, with a bad fiduciary rule, you could have a standard that ends up weaker than the existing standard for advisors and no strengthened standard or not meaningfully strengthened standard for brokers. Beyond that sort of worst-case outcome, and I think the good news there is I don't think you could get, you know, we would oppose that. All of the advocates for a fiduciary would oppose that. And so you'd get inaction, I think, rather than adoption of a bad rule if the SEC moved in that direction. The other areas where there's real potential for problems, so there's been mentioned several times this issue of a limited menu of products. So take it to its most, you know, sort of the extreme. You have someone who sells only one variable annuity. That's their menu of products, and it has backed by a shaking insurance company, and it's got a poor selection of substandard investment options within the annuity. It's not good for anyone. But if it's the best of what they have to offer, does that satisfy a fiduciary standard? So one is sort of ridiculously narrow, but where do you cross that line? How do you define a menu of products, a limited menu, that it has to be sufficiently broad that it would be possible to act in someone's best interest based on a recommendation from that menu? The other thing is, you know, this issue of how they define ongoing duty of care. The Dodd-Frank Act has this language about there's no fiduciary duty after the ongoing duty after the advice has been rendered. Well, what does that mean? You know, right now, investors bring successful claims against brokers in arbitration for violation of fiduciary duty on the grounds that they created a reasonable expectation that there would be ongoing oversight. Are we going to lose that under a bad fiduciary rule? And then I think finally the other outcome, we've talked a lot, you know, one of the problems, the big firms will adjust. Firms that have a broad array of product offerings will adjust. This is going to be the most difficult to adapt to for small firms with a limited menu. Typically, the insurance agent who calls himself a financial planner and sells maybe a few variable annuities, maybe some mutual funds, and that's the scope of their retirement planning. And one possibility, if you got a good fiduciary standard, is that individual then goes out and stops selling securities entirely, just sells equity indexed annuities instead, which are insurance products, and falls outside the reach of the SEC rulemaking. It's one reason that DOL rulemaking is so important, is that it is not subject to this same limitation. SEC only covers advice about securities. DOL covers a broader range of services. So I think those are some of the risks. I think they're avoidable, and I think they're well understood by, you know, the commissioners at the SEC who are supportive of fiduciary rulemaking. But those are some of the traps that will have to be avoided.
Thanks, Barb. Sounds like you have a nice soundtrack behind you with your remarks. This next question comes from Christopher Carosa of Fiduciary News. And he says, what everyone is saying is really great and quite on point and has been stated repeatedly over the years. Sometimes I get the sense of preaching to the choir. If this is really coming down to a political issue and fiduciary advocates clearly don't have the lobbying clout of those against the fiduciary standard, what is the plan to reach out to the broader arena of public opinion on this? Anyone?
So go ahead.
So let me take a shot at that. I mean, we have
We're trying to talk to as many people as possible, and this is David Sertner with AARP. We've been talking about this issue in our publications and our other outreach. We've conducted two surveys over the last 2 years, one of plan sponsors and one of plan participants, asking some of these various questions and making those public. Obviously, meeting with policymakers and trying to educate policymakers on the Hill and in the administration. So we are trying to certainly do our due diligence in getting out there and talking to as many people as possible. I mean, we certainly find over the years that having as much sunshine and much information out there as possible can help move this debate in the right direction. But obviously, we're battling with an industry that has a lot of money and has put a lot of money behind fighting these roles. And that's, as with any fight that we engage in, the really well-moneyed source behind it, it's always difficult.
Great. This next question comes from Ted Knutson. If the Republicans take control of the Senate, could this lessen the chances for a fiduciary standard since they will be able to delay the appointment of SEC nominees they don't like indefinitely?
So this is Barb.
Well, this is...
Go ahead, Dennis. If that's... I mean,
no,
so
I was
this
just
is Barb. I'll jump in and start, and then you can join. I would say, first of all, the biggest threat if you had a Republican Senate is that they, I mean, I think they'd be less likely to stop an SEC rulemaking than a DOL, try to stop a DOL rulemaking. Their biggest threat in that arena is a rider on an appropriations bill, but they never pass appropriations bills anymore. So, by having made the appropriations process itself so dysfunctional, I think they've also robbed themselves of one of the most effective tools that Congress has used in the past to attack regulations it didn't like. But the other thing is the DOL just needs to get out and get moving. And move the process along and then let people stand up and explain to the public why they don't want financial advisors to have to act in their best interest.
Got it. This next question is from Mark Sheff of Investment News. He has a two-part question. One part, you believe SIFMA is an ally of on SEC fiduciary duty. Why? The Institute for Fiduciary Standards sees SIFMA as an obstacle.
So this is Barb, and I'll jump in just because I think there's a slightly different... SIFMA has taken a stronger position on fiduciary standard at the SEC than the SEC has. So if you read the SIFMA letter and take it at face value, SIFMA has said that it supports adoption of a fiduciary standard governing personalized investment advice and that it supports inclusion of a broad principles-based best interest standard as part of that. Does that mean that we will then agree on everything else about what the rule should look like? No. And everything else is fairly important. But it is different from the sort of all-out, just say no, over our dead body approach that they've taken to DOL. And it does, and I think one reason that that may be is I think they have a better chance of getting a rule that they can live with out of the SEC than they do out of DOL. But I think there's a difference between sort of drawing that distinction and saying that we're somehow all in agreement on what this needs to look like.
This is Dennis at Better Markets on that. Look, I think that the potential distinction there may be much more rhetorical than it is substantive. And Barbara kind of hit it, which is while you can read the letter where they talk about advice, everything will turn on how the word advice gets defined at the SEC, which SIFMA has consistently found to be a very hospitable, friendly arena. And I think that they correctly understand that the Department of Labor appears to be serious about proposing a rule that will not be loophole-ridden, that will allow them to, through definitions and permitted exceptions, to evade the rule, which I think that they expect they will be able to do in the SEC rulemaking process.
And this Mary, I apologize. I somehow wasn't able to be online. But let me say that another reason why we really need to think about the details here is that we've got various parts of the industry jockeying for position with respect to the SEC's plans to do rulemaking. I think what the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard is trying to do here is important because from the standpoint of an advisor, you've got two components to a fiduciary duty. One is the education and the skill that's required to perform the service or do the work. Credentials, continuing education requirements, evidence of skills, that kind of thing. But the other thing, which has not been addressed adequately in the profession, is the character standard. That is the oath, the procedures that manage conflicts in favor of the client, the written disclosures. And these are the details that SIFMA doesn't want to get into. They can say the big words, but they can't really get into the definition without tying themselves in a knot. So I'd like to just kind of run through a couple of these really important character standards that would signify best practices. And the hope here is that the industry and various components in the industry or groups in the industry can adopt these and then move beyond what dependency on rulemaking at the SEC, although I think it would be very helpful. So here's number one. Be proactive about the conflict of interest. Discourage advisors from giving conflicted advice. Encourage them to avoid conflicts. Require conflicts to be mitigated, even neutralized, and require that in writing to the client. Number two, be transparent about compensation costs. There's only three of these, so transparent about compensation costs. There are two different numbers. What is the advisor paid? And the fees associated with the investment over time. Now, both of those numbers reduce the results to the investor, ultimately. So have a requirement that these numbers be published as estimates and provided as actual. I like sort of the restaurant menu receipt kind of idea where you actually can look through a menu and see what the costs are. And then you get a receipt when you've finished your financial planning or your advisory transaction with all the costs involved. And number three, speak to the investors in lay terms. I know the SEC has started to do that with ADV Part 2, plain language, but this stuff cannot be in the kind of disclosures that have heretofore gone before us. They're too complicated. They don't just say what needs to be said. So bottom line, I think, is we need to create a fish tank in the industry that everybody wants to swim in and then hold that up to the community of investors and say, this is where you get the advice that is truly in your best interest. And I'll stop there.
Thanks so much, Mary. And thanks, everybody, for joining today.
Hey, Tara?
Yes.
You know, just a couple of things in conclusion. You know, one of the things people forget, all we're talking about here is getting the Department of Labor and the SEC to propose rules for public comment. Not talking about finalization. We're talking about having a public, transparent process that people can comment on. So I think it's important we can get lost in the details and the pros and the cons and where SIFMA is and where Wall Street is and where the industry is and everything else. But all we're talking about is the overriding importance of the issue to tens of millions of Americans and whether or not the SEC and the Department of Labor will actually just propose a rule and open it up for public comment. And let's see where it goes from there. What is the industry so afraid of that they don't even want a proposed rule? And that tells you, I think, that tells everybody more than they need to know about what the industry's real motive is here. So
Amen.
I thought that might
yeah,
be it.
That's a really great point. It's just getting to
Amen.
Step one. Well, great. Thanks so much for those concluding remarks. That's helpful. And thanks again to everybody for joining. Take care.
Thank you, Tara.
Thanks, Tara.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.